Hello and welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast with me, Matt Beadle, and the freshly trimmed voice of goalkeeping, Richard Lee.
Indeed, I am. How are we, Matthew?
Good, thank you, mate. We are doing this, like we've said before, over the medium of Zoom. So I can see you right now. I'm looking right at you, and that's pretty sharp.
That is, and that's what happens when you try and do it yourself, my friend.
Doesn't look too bad though, mate. It looks pretty good, actually. And speaking of things pretty good, our previous podcast on whether Peter Schmeichel would make it in the modern game did prompt a bit of feedback. I did, upon your request, post a poll on Twitter. Now, before I reveal the results, let's just reiterate the fact that you, Richard Lee, were questioning whether Peter Schmeichel would be able to adapt to the modern game. This is correct, yes?
That's what I was saying, yes.
Okay, well, I can officially reveal the results from that poll as to how the Great Dane Peter Schmeichel would fare in today's goalkeeping climate. 82.2% of respondents said absolutely yes, he would not have a problem.
There you go. I can't help but feel that, you know, it was catching up. Had it been another day's worth of the poll, maybe it would have been 50-50. We'll never know, but look, I'll let you have this one.
Well, thank you very much for that, mate. I'll just run through some of the responses we had. Slightly varied in the interests of balance. Gaz Tomlinson said Schmeichel was unbelievable with his feet and well ahead of his time. Graham McNeil, he's my favourite player ever, but I think in today's climate of keepers getting blamed for anything, even he would struggle. So there you go. Tom Riddler did say the man was a genius who was well ahead of his time. Who is to say he wouldn't be developing further the goalkeeping position if he were playing today? Any era, he would be top of the pile. Jordan Platt, I think he'd initially struggle with one-on-ones, getting chipped now and then, but would adapt his style. Didn't have the best ball control with his feet, but neither do a lot of keepers today. That's fair comment. Rob Johnston, look at his son if you want to see the low to middle end of how the father would fare. And there's nothing against Junior in that. He's a great keeper in his own right. So there you go. Plenty of responses, really, and varied. Thank you to everybody who responded and to those who voted. We do also have a bit of correspondence before we move on. We've had an email in from Stephen Oreo in Brisbane, Australia. This is directly to you, Rich. Now, I wasn't sure whether I wanted to read this one out in fear of inflating that brilliantly shaved ego of yours even more, but I think it's fair, again, in the interest of balance, to read this out. Stephen has said, this is directly addressed to you, by the way, not me. He's not addressed it to me. Hi, Richard. Just finished all of your podcasts. Absolutely brilliant. Really learned a lot. I watched your highlights as recommended. Did you recommend people watch your highlights?
I'm sure I did. And if I haven't, I do recommend.
Okay. Well, he says, you were a legend. One of the best shot stoppers I've seen. Top three of all time. It goes David De Gea, Joe Hart, and Richard Lee. Well done, he says. Have you thought about a comeback? Chelsea needs a number one. Keep up the great work.
Well, there you go. And just, if you can send him an email, let him know. I will sort him out that £50 ASAP.
Thank you again, Stephen Oreo from Brisbane. If you'd like to hear your voice heard and maybe offer an alternative take on Richard Lee's goalkeeping exploits, it's very easy to do so. Hello at goalkeepersunion.net, at GK Union on Twitter.
Or tremendous save by Benetti. And as Gray pulls this in, what's the flick, and then the great save. A tremendous effort, reflex effort by Peter Benetti.
Right, let's move on to today's chat, Richard. This is a subject quite close to home for you, for the goalkeeping fraternity, for the football world as a whole, really, and especially those closely linked to the man himself, family, friends, and everyone in between. Sadly, following a long-term illness, Peter Benetti passed away recently at the age of 78. Now, this was a long-term illness not related to coronavirus, I believe. We've waited a couple of weeks to do this, just to let the dust settle a bit, observing the tributes pouring in and now offering our own take, in a sense, on Peter Benetti, the Cat, known affectionately as the Cat, of course, bagged a whole host of honours during his career. NFA Youth Cup, Chelsea's first ever at the time in 1960, a League Cup, an FA Cup, a Cup Winners' Cup, two promotions, and let's not forget a World Cup winners' medal. He didn't play in 1966, but he was in the squad and did belatedly receive that medal back in 2009. So very much worth mentioning. He was also a runner-up in the 1969-70 Footballer of the Year Awards. He made 729 appearances for Chelsea across two spells over two decades. Only Ron Chopper-Harris has more appearances for the club, 208 clean sheets in that time as well. That's a record surpassed only by Petr Cech in 2014. He also, and I thought this was quite interesting, played more than 30 times in 13 league campaigns for Chelsea. Very, very decent stats, especially when you consider he was coming to his late 30s, early 40s during the tail end of that career. But Rich, he holds a special place in your heart and your goalkeeping development, really, for that matter. Peter Benetti was your very first goalkeeper coach as a youngster.
He was. Yeah, funnily enough, there's been a bit, so many different links with Chelsea over the years, and partly because at Watford, we had Gianluca Vialli came in and he brought in the likes of Kevin Hitchcock. I then worked with Eddie Neddy up in Blackburn when I went there for a period of time. Before all that, 15 years old, and thankfully, my school at the time, last year doing GCSEs, because it had already been agreed that I was going to sign for Watford the year after, they allowed me to have a day off every week to go and train with Watford. And it'd always be a Thursday. And the reason being was that Peter Benetti was the coach at Watford on a Thursday. So it was back in the day of Kevin Miller and Alec Chamberlain, for Watford fans that are listening in. And do you know what? I look back now, and at the time, without fully appreciating who he was, the experience I had during that time really stood me in good stead. A lot of the exercises he put on were very, very good. He was an excellent coach. But the point was that he was, as a person, just a very welcoming, warm human being. And I think for a 15-year-old, you can imagine how nervous I was going in. Not only the likes of Kevin Miller, big personality, Alec Chamberlain, been in the game for years, Peter Benetti, I was aware, obviously, of what he had achieved. Just touched on a few of the things there. But to go in and feel as welcome as I did, and I used to really look forward to Thursday each week, not just because I would go the day off school, of course, but to go in and work with him, because he was just so welcoming. And a lot of the advice he would give throughout the session, just having a quiet word here and there, and never making you feel, I don't know how to put it, but making you feel stupid almost, because of course, Alec and Kevin were so far advanced as to where I was at. I was 15, I was so small really as well. I felt so weak compared to them and the kind of drills they're doing, the ferocity that they're hitting the ball, but he would really work with you. You know, and I know Alec as well, massive, massive fan of the work that he did. And really, the two or three years that I did with him, and he was there for a period of time, he used to train up at Stanmore, the period of time that he was there, it really had a big impact on my game. He was essentially the first professional goalkeeper coach that I had.
It's funny you mention the fact that you felt really small compared to Kevin Miller and Alec Chamberlain, because Benetti himself, around 5 feet 10 and a half, only around 11 stone when he was a player. So I guess for you, that probably helped in a way, did it? I mean, he wasn't a man mountain of a coach.
It's one of them as well. You know, when you meet someone, and I always remember before the first session with him, conversation I'd had with people around me, and they were arguably more impressed than I was, because it didn't mean a lot to him. I was 15, and of course at the time I was looking up to the likes of Peter Schmeichel and some of the other guys that were around then, not necessarily looking back at the likes of a Peter Benetti, but my dad and other people around, they knew exactly what Peter Benetti had achieved, who he was. So when they first heard that I was going to work with him, he was built up in my mind to be this huge character of the game. Now, look, as a character, huge character, absolutely, and a fantastic person. But when you meet him face to face, I was taller than him. Even at that age, I was a little bit taller than him. And it was strange to know how well he had done, especially at that era in particular. It felt like goalkeeping had already changed. Goalkeepers were 6'2", 6'3". We touched on Peter Schmeichel and we had a good conversation about this. And goalkeepers were tending to take that sort of frame. You had to have that sort of frame. So to meet Peter Benetti and to understand the success he had had at the height that he was kind of inspiring as well. You know, I guess there were certain bits I certainly took from that, and the way in which I tried to maximise my game in regards to my spring, my power, my speed. Obviously, that was what he was known for. You mentioned the term the cat, and that's stuck now with so many different goalkeepers. It's a common term now used, and really, essentially, he coined that term, not him himself, but the way in which he played. And the bits and pieces that I've seen, of course, there's not loads and loads of footage back then, unfortunately, but the bits and pieces I have seen, I love watching goalkeepers like that, you know, and I think maybe because of the way in which I played, like I'm always a little bit, the goalkeepers that are 6'7" and aren't necessarily the most mobile, I don't enjoy watching them play that much, maybe because I'm a little bit biased because of the way in which I was taught. So watching someone like him, who was so athletic, springy, moved so well, I quite enjoy watching goalkeepers like that. So the footage that I have seen is fantastic to see. You know, look, the term legend is bandied around a lot, and often it's fair to say that it's not used appropriately. But I think in his case, certainly when it comes to Chelsea in particular, what he achieved, you just touched on so many of the things that he achieved. I think it's very safe to say that he is a Chelsea legend.
You mentioned the footage, and there is still some footage floating around, actually. We're going to analyse a bit of that later on in the podcast. We've got goalkeeping enthusiast Clayton Bierman from the Chelsea Fancast coming on to talk about his memories of watching the cat. And then while I'm kind of counteracting the very point I'm trying to make about a lot of the focus since his passing, bizarrely, being on that ill-fated quarterfinal against West Germany at the 1970 World Cup, we are indeed going to reference it purely to provide a more balanced opinion on that performance, as opposed to the much maligned murmurings we've become accustomed to from the past. But for you, Rich, what stood out from his sessions? Anything in particular you can draw on from those days rocking up to training as a kid?
Well, look, you know, I mentioned the drills that we did were very good. And I look back now and actually they're all very much game related. The one thing he couldn't do actually, but he was quite open about this, was at that age, because he was a bit older then when he was coaching us, and he couldn't necessarily strike it as hard as he'd want to. So he'd often get us to serve, which wasn't necessarily a bad thing. But the drills that he was putting on, a lot of them were very simple, it has to be said. But I quite like that. And I've spoken about this in depth. I do it a lot on my Insta show with a lot of the guys that we talk to, a lot of the coaches, where, look, it's great. You go out and you see a training session. You've got loads of cones, hurdles, bollards, whatever you've got. And aesthetically, it looks really pleasing. But actually, the work you do isn't necessarily realistic. For me and for a lot of goalkeepers, they just want to get out there and graft, get out there and work, face the ball at speed, moving around, short, sharp movements, powerful, explosive. And that was the way in which I remember the Peter Bonetti sessions, was that he had a certain way about him that would make you feel motivated, make you feel inspired. I mean, look, it's quite a simple equation, but if you've got goalkeepers that feel inspired and feel motivated, and you're putting on exercises, putting on drills that are going to work them, are going to increase their power output, increase their speed, increase their hand-eye coordination, their handling skills, it's quite simple to put on a good goalkeeping session. One of the hardest bits is the mentality that the goalkeeper coach has and the energy that the goalkeeper coach can bring to the session. And I know that a lot of goalkeeper coaches listening in will agree with this. You can have the best session in the world laid out, but if you come out with a bit of a bad attitude, or you're not necessarily pumped up yourself, that will then feed into the goalkeepers you work with, and you can very quickly have a bit of a drab session, even with all the best preparation. So I think, for me, the biggest thing that Peter Bonetti did, he kept it simple. He did the right kind of things that goalkeepers liked, but it was just the way in which he put the session on. He was making you feel 10-foot tall. He was complimenting you when necessary. He was finding the little faults in your game where he could help improve and dissecting it where he could. But for me, it was his energy that he brought to the session.
And you've always said throughout the time of us doing this podcast, haven't you, that every goalkeeper will always remember his or her first ever goalkeeper coach. And that is what he's always going to be to you.
Yeah, he was. You know, if I were to look before that, I'd briefly worked with a guy called Stuart Murdoch, who, in fact, some will know, he went on to manage a couple of clubs and was goalkeeper coach a few places, but that was only quite brief. I did a bit with Chris Cummins, who, again, some will know, at Watford, but wasn't really a goalkeeper coach. So, right, for me, he was definitely the first professional goalkeeper coach that I worked with on a regular basis. And yeah, I look back and I guess it's hard to quantify what impact it had, because it was for a couple of years, and they were a really good couple of years in terms of my development. And I suppose I look back now, without even knowing it, a lot of the information he gave me, I still pass on today. So I guess my lasting memory of him will be more as a human being than as a goalkeeper coach. Just the way in which he made me feel, going in every Thursday, a 15-year-old boy, so much younger than every other goalkeeper there, and feeling quite small and I guess very nervous going into those sessions, but just the way in which he calmed me down, made me feel, and I guess the confidence he gave me.
Nice one, Rich. Very well put. That is a goalkeeper's perspective, a colleague's perspective, I guess you could say, on Peter Bonetti. We're now going to hear from a fan's perspective, a Chelsea fan's perspective. Clayton Bierman of the Chelsea Fancast, a long-standing and hugely successful Chelsea podcast, hashtag pass the pod. I caught up with him for a bit of chat about the cat.
Oh, ball went in trouble. Now it's Cooper. And it's ripped in again by Bonetti from Cooper. And Cooper snapping up that mistake by Baldwin. Bonetti covering the near post and brilliantly turning it round the post.
Well, Clayton, great to have you on the show. Unfortunately, it is in slightly sad circumstances, but we're going to try and take the positives here and speak about Peter Bonetti, the cat, great Chelsea goalkeeper, of course, spells with St. Louis Stars in the US, Dundee United and Woking during his career, but it was at Chelsea where he will really be remembered, and someone that you in particular remember quite fondly.
He's my hero in terms, you know, footballing hero, always has been. And it's amazing that throughout my watching of Chelsea, throughout that time, and it doesn't matter how many great players have come and gone, when anybody asks me who's your favourite player, it's Peter Benetti, and it still hasn't changed. He was just a great goalkeeper, as far as I'm concerned. And the one thing that I would say about him is he was consistent. I wrote an obit for the Fancast website, and I was trying to think of specific things that he would do or specific saves I could remember. And the thing that came across to me in terms of my own memories was his consistency. Now, obviously, there was the 1970 Cup final and replay where he was outstanding in both games, the second game even more so considering he played on one leg. But the one thing that, as I say, that sticks out for me more than anything else is his consistency, is the fact that he was always there and he always did what you expected him to do. And that's the greatest praise I think I can give him, to be honest.
You mentioned the 1970 FA Cup final there against Leeds. Of course, it was an epic final for so many reasons. It went to a replay, that one. You mentioned the injury as well. What was that like, watching that final, seeing a goalkeeper in action like that? Because you imagine in today's game, I mean, there have been other examples, I suppose, over the years of goalkeepers refusing to go off. I think of Les Seeley in the 91 Rumbelows Cup final. I can think of Hugo Lloris in a game for Spurs, I think against Everton a few years back. But back then, I mean, that type of leg injury, would no way would he be kept on the pitch in these times.
Well, it's a funny story. My dad went to his testimonial dinner. And so his testimonial year was the year after the Cup final. It was 1971. And he said that they played the cup final, parts of the cup final and the replay, and there were different angles. And they said that one angle was basically they showed you him being treated for the injury, and his knee was apparently growing as you were watching this piece of film. It was a really bad injury. And of course, in those days, there was only a substitute, and it was an outfield player. So in the first instance, he would have been reluctant to go off. But yeah, no, it was just true fear, because in the first game, he was outstanding. He arguably kept us in the game. He performed like he always did, you know, immaculately. And so watching that game and sort of 0-0 at the time, and he went down and you thought, oh my, you know, I was absolutely terrified. But he just carried on, which was extraordinary. If you look at Lee's first goal, or only goal in that replay, he was completely incapacitated. It happened, I can't remember, would have been about 5-10 minutes afterwards. And you can see his movement is just completely prohibited. And I'm not saying would have saved it if he hadn't been injured, but I think he would have had a lot better chance. Something that somebody has recounted since he's passed away was that, and you wouldn't have got this watching it on telly, is that at the end of full time, he went off, obviously, for treatment. And they said that the roar when he came back out of the dressing room was probably louder than when we scored the winner. So, yeah, really important.
In terms of his style as well, Clayton, when you read some of the quotes that the ex-teammates have given out, I saw John Hollins essentially saying he was the original sweeper-keeper to an extent, the first goalkeeper to come out and dribble the ball, whereas Chopper Harris, old Ron Harris, essentially said that he could do everything, but what he couldn't do was kick the ball. Did you ever see that when he was playing? Did he struggle to kind of kick the ball far? It seemed like players were the ones taking goal kicks.
His only weakness was his kicking, dead ball kicking. He would never, well, say never, he would very rarely reach the halfway line with a dead ball kick, which in the modern game would be unheard of. But the one thing that compensated for that was his swiftness of throwing the ball out. So in the sort of the mid to late 60s, Chelsea attacked through fullbacks, which was a bit ahead of its time. And the swiftness of the ball being thrown by Benetti to the fullbacks was a great attacking weapon. And what he was also brilliant at was coming for the ball in the air, which we've discussed on the show previously. you know, the fact that goalkeeping has changed and evolved so much. But he was always brave and always coming.
I have to say, another thing that I've noticed as well from the past when watching clips of Benetti, and it was quite synonymous with a lot of goalkeepers from the time, I think, but just the fact that he bounced the ball so much before he'd either kicked it or, like you say, gave out that textbook throw. But it was a case of collecting it, bounce, running a few steps, bounce, bounce again, and then distributing.
Yeah, I think it's weird now because a whole generation has grown up on seeing a goalkeeper having supposedly 12 seconds to release the ball. And so if you watch any games from the 70s, watching players, and especially goalkeepers, basically play basketball over and over again before they kick the ball out, is now looks really, really weird. But yeah, his drop kicking wasn't too bad. But as I say, his dead ball kicking was not good. But yeah, I think sort of, as we say, there was a quick release at times, but other times, because the game was so much slower, it wasn't as important for the ball leaving the goalkeeper's hands, because when it went to defenders, there wasn't somebody on that defender immediately. So that was such a noticeable style from what we watch today.
Okay, Clayton, it's been great having you on, mate. Like I said, in slightly sad circumstances, but great to hear some brilliant stories from yourself. Just as a final message, really, the floor is yours. What would you like to say as a parting word on Peter Benetti?
For me personally, I just feel really glad that I had an opportunity to see live for quite a few years a true Chelsea legend. He's everything about him was class. He was an innovator, which I think is something which may come out in the weeks and months ahead. He was the first one, as far as I'm aware, that wore gloves and then developed those gloves. His kits were immaculate. And it's a very sad loss to the club, obviously to his family. And I just want to thank him for the years of pleasure that he gave me.
Absolutely. Well said. Clayton, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Newton is going with Fuller. Fuller is in and shots him. What a save by Peter Benetti.
Clayton Bierman there from the Chelsea Fancast. Great bunch of guys you can catch via iTunes and plenty of other podcast providers. Now, Rich, for the final part of this Benetti tribute, as promised, a bit of Peter Benetti analysis, because, well, I don't really think this has been done properly before. At least I can't recall it ever being done. So as I alluded to earlier in the show, I was initially a bit reticent to include this. But when I was reading some of the tributes to Benetti and the obituary in The Guardian, it has to be noted, despite all the great achievements of his career, actually led with the 1970 World Cup, which did surprise me. Now, the story goes, I'm sure many people know, he came in for Gordon Banks in that quarterfinal against West Germany, England, of course, the holders from 4 years earlier. Banks had pulled out last minute with food poisoning. So Benetti, fresh from the FA Cup final performance we've spoken of against Leeds, was drafted in. England took a 2-0 lead in the game, but then relinquished that lead and eventually lost it in extra time, with it losing their grip on the Jules Rimet trophy, of course. Benetti, heavily criticised at the time, suggested by many that he was at fault for the first two and possibly even the third West Germany goal. So I just want to analyse it, really, because I don't think that was ever done properly back in the day, and I think he deserves it. So let's have a look at the three goals. We're going to start with the opener from Franz Beckenbauer, the biggest case for criticism of the lot, I guess. It did slip through his body, yet there is also the case to be raised that centre-back and captain Bobby Moore, later to be Sir Bobby Moore, of course, was then completely out of position when Beckenbauer took his effort on goal. I think he was injured further up the pitch. What's your take on that first goal?
Yeah, no, I'll try and look at this as objectively as I can, because naturally, you know, emotion will kick in, and being slightly biased, I want to say that none of them were his fault. But let's look at it as objectively as we possibly can. And the first one, will he be disappointed? Yes, of course he will. The thing we need to bear in mind is, as Beckenbauer takes it to his right and strikes the ball in the way that he does, you can see, and this is the one we talk about so often, about that strike where the ball barely spins. And for me, I've watched it a few times. It's one of the difficult things to do when you're looking at old footage, is actually tell whether there is spin on the ball, because let's be honest, the quality of the footage is nowhere near what we see now. Like now, we would get the HD vision where we would see in detail whether it's spinning or whether there's that slight movement, whether it's a Ronaldo-esque stripe, that one where there is no spin on the ball, where it just moves ever so slightly. You can't really see that. However, what I would say, look at the technique Beckenbauer uses, where it's almost like a flat foot, I would say, in a weird way. It's almost like if you were to do a half volley. It's that technique. And the ball definitely deviates ever so slightly. It definitely dips ever so slightly. So I don't think it's a simple rule to deal with. I don't think it's one where he's dived to his right and he's seen it the whole way. I do think there's some movement on the ball. I do think it's dipped ever so slightly. Now, does that mean it's not his fault? No, I think he would look at it and still be very disappointed. Looking at the second one, look, it's not his fault. It's funny how people could... It's very easy, and this often happens when a goalkeeper makes an error or is what is believed to be an error. You'll then look for further errors because then all of a sudden, you're on a bit of a downer. You're on the negative. People are then going to try and pick holes. Now, for this one, if you were to pause it the moment that the header is made, he may be ever so slightly out of position, ever so slightly, not a lot. But, of course, that will be a reason for them to pick. Had he not made the first error for the first goal, then I don't think people pick on this at all. But the fact that the first one had gone in, and it's one where it's a horrible one for a keeper because it looks like it's almost gone through you, then, of course, you're going to look for error in two or three. Could he have done better with the second one? I think his positioning is off by about half a yard. Now, if positioning's correct, possibly he might be able to dive back and get a hand to it, but maybe not. It was a fantastic header. To have the awareness, to have his back to goal in the way that he did, and get the header, get the leverage on the header in the way that he did, I think we need to credit the player for the goal itself, as opposed to look at the goalkeeper and question the goalkeeper, in my opinion. And the third one, no, absolutely no chance. His movement was good across the goal. He got to the near post, ball was flicked to the back post, got across the goal. The only thing he might have done is thrown himself, but it would have been one where, you know, some days you get lucky, some days you don't. But no, absolutely no error on the third one. Second one is, you know, we love an error rating, don't we? You're probably talking a 1 out of 10. It was the first one is the one that then kills you. And the second you have that first goal go in the way that it does, people will then look to pick holes in two or three. But even the first one, I'll ask you to do that again. Look at the strike. Look at the way in which it moves ever so slightly. I just wish we had HD vision back then, because I think then people would look at these slightly differently, because we would have seen a bit more movement on the first and people wouldn't have questioned the second or third.
It is also worth noting as well, after that first goal from Beckenbauer, he made a very good point blank save from Gert Müller. It's also worth noting that England squandered chances at the other end. When you watch those highlights as well, there were a few chances that went begging for England. He made a very good stop from Beckenbauer in extra time as well. And I agree with you. It was Uwe Seeler. He was the one who scored the second goal. Something of a freak header, really. It was a long ball in by Karl-Heinz Schnellinger. Lobbed in. You could argue again, could the English defence have done better? And for the third as well, Terry Cooper was the left back at the time. He was absolutely annihilated by Jürgen Grabowski, who was the West German substitution, who lofted in that great ball to the far post. I've read in some reports that Benetti wasn't able to gather the cross. Absolute nonsense. It was all the way at the far post. Keith Newton, who was the right back, I believe, he probably should have maybe won the header. Brian Lebone let Gerd Müller go and he squeezed in between Lebone and Bobby Moore. So absolutely not at fault for both two. But it is funny, isn't it? Because we're going all the way back to the 1970s here, 1970 to be exact, yet those same arguments are still occurring today.
It's the same, and it's a lack of understanding. It's the same thing. Let's go on that third one, because you're right. There is not a goalkeeper in the world that could come for the cross. The only goalkeeper that comes for that third cross is a goalkeeper that's got their positioning wrong, because they need to be at the front post. For the ball that's gone over in the way that it has, you need to be at your front post. The moment you are, you're not going to be able to change direction quick enough to catch the cross for the third one. The only way you'd have done it is if you were lazy, didn't get your footwork right in the first place, and then you were able to come and catch the cross. So it would have been almost like by cheating or by a negative that would have turned into a positive. So again, it's a lack of goalkeeping knowledge, certainly with that one. The other bit that I'll touch on, because it came up in the podcast the other day, and I made the point that, you know, Schmeichel, in my opinion, was at fault for the first goal against Bayern Munich. Now, the reason I mention that is this is where I do believe luck plays a part in goalkeeping. And I say this on the back of David Seaman, Ronaldinho. Do you know what? If England go on and win that game, we've forgotten about that. Like we have generally forgotten, apart from me apparently, forgotten about the goal that Schmeichel let in against Bayern Munich. But what happens if United didn't score those two goals in the final minute? Are we talking about Peter Schmeichel in the same way in which people have sometimes spoke about Peter Benetti, or people sometimes speak about David Seaman? And these are the bits where it's got nothing to do with anything you're doing. Sometimes you need a bit of luck. Sometimes you need a bit of luck, like Peter Schmeichel had in the final, where United get the two goals in the final minute and he sails off into the sunset as a legend, as a hero. If they hadn't have got those two goals, I do wonder whether that tarnishes his reputation ever so slightly, in the same way in which people still question Peter Benetti, people still question David Seaman, which for me is just so unfair.
Well, certainly not questioned by Chelsea. I'm just going to finish this one off with part of the statement that they released shortly after his sad passing. He was the cat who broke the mold, defied the odds, drew the gasps, earned the cheers and got the cream, all in front of an adoring Stamford Bridge, one of our indisputable all-time great players. Lovely words.
I couldn't have put it better myself.
Lovely stuff. We shall be back in the not-too-distant future with another goalkeeping debate. From me, it is goodbye. From Richard.
Goodbye.
This has been the Goalkeepers Union podcast. We'll see you next time.
Bad luck for Leeds that they were up against Bonetti in tremendous form. On this showing, perhaps the best goalkeeper in the world.